I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we have breaking news for you. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has quit. He is dropping out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination. He's speaking right now before the Conservative Political Action Committee. Let's listen.
I hate to lose my family, my friends, you, my supporters across the country. You've given a great deal to get me where I have a shot to becoming president. If this were only about me, I'd go on, but it's never been only about me. I entered this race because I love America. And because I love America, in this time of war, I feel I have to now stand aside for our party and for our country. You guys are great. I will continue to stand for conservative principles. I'll fight alongside you for all the things we believe in. And one of the things we believe in is that we cannot allow the next president of the United States to retreat in the face of evil extremism. It is the common task of each generation and the burden of liberty to preserve this country, expand its freedoms, and renew its spirit so that its noble past is prologue to its glorious future. To this task, accepting this burden, we're all dedicated, and I firmly believe by the providence of the Almighty that we will succeed beyond our fondest hope. America must always remain, as it has always been, the hope of the earth. Thank you so very much. I love you. Thank you.
That's Mitt Romney effectively conceding the Republican nomination for president to his chief rival, John McCain, speaking at the Conservative Political Action Committee in Washington today and looking very emotional as he did so. We want to take a couple minutes with Dan Payne, a Democratic strategist who knows Romney very well, covering him here for the Boston Globe. Dan, no one's truly surprised by this, but your thoughts on Romney leading the campaign?
Well, he wasn't what he tried to be, which is a right-wing zealot, and today, in front of the conservative conference, he's trying to be a right-wing zealot again. He misread the electorate. He misinterpreted his own record. He ran a terrible campaign. He threw money at the states. He pandered. He was a different candidate every state he ran in. And he fundamentally just wasn't ready to make the run. He hadn't really thought it through.
Well, your opinion would seem to coincide with Republicans who were not voting for him. But, of course, he had passionate supporters in right-wing radio, Rush Limbaugh, who led the attack against John McCain. What happens now? I mean, how does this group of people that he's speaking to, these conservatives who wanted Mitt Romney, even though, as you said, 15, 20 years ago they would not have, given his stance then, how do they now turn around and embrace John McCain?
Well, they're going to have to swallow hard and do it for the sake of trying to control things like the Supreme Court and other decisions that a president can make pretty much unilaterally, and hope that McCain will at least be tolerant of their views.
And Dan Payne, I just have one quick question. What do you think Mitt Romney does now? And this is a man who is not used to losing.
My guess is that he probably will go underground. We won't hear much from him for a while. He'll reemerge at the convention. He'll probably try to do some campaigning for McCain out west and perhaps in New England. And he'll, ultimately, I have no idea where he'll end up. He might end up in a Washington think tank. He may move to Utah. He may move to Michigan. His future is kind of a blank slate right now.
Okay, that's Dan Payne, a Democratic strategist who writes for the Boston Globe, has covered Mitt Romney, who has dropped out of the race today. Later in the program, we'll hear the Republican response. But Dan, thanks for weighing in on this breaking news.
You're welcome.
Well, remember early on in the presidential debates when the main issue was immigration, you know, whether Hillary Clinton agreed with a move to license illegal immigrants, whether or not John McCain was pulling back on his immigration reform. Now the remaining candidates are being asked about the economy, and New York Times reporter David Leonhardt gets to say, "I told you so." Months ago, he wrote that the economy would ultimately be more important than any race since 1992. Now it is the economy, stupid, again. Well, earlier today, we spoke with David at length on a range of economic issues. This was before Mitt Romney ended his bid for the White House. I started with taxes, President Bush's tax cuts, and cuts that are expected to expire in 2010. And so this means that whoever is in office will decide whether they should be extended. We began with John McCain, who initially opposed the cuts.
He opposed the tax cuts, he said, for a few reasons. One, he thought it was inappropriate to cut taxes in a time of war. That has rarely, if ever, been done previously in American history. And he also thought they were too skewed toward high-income households, toward the wealthy. And he thought that if you were going to cut taxes, particularly in a time of war, you had to accompany it with spending cuts.
Okay.
And that they weren't doing that. So those were the reasons, all the reasons that he opposed it back then.
Right, and he felt it, as critics do, that the tax cut benefited the wealthy at the expense of the middle class, and those in favor of tax cuts feel that it stimulates the economy. But where is John McCain now on the tax cut?
John McCain now, so when he voted against them, he was one of the only Republicans in the Senate to do so. Now he is in favor of making permanent all of President Bush's income tax cuts. So the cuts on people at every point along the income distribution. He's a little bit less aggressive on the estate tax. He doesn't want the complete abolition of the estate tax as President Bush and Mitt Romney do. But he's in favor of the making permanent all of the income tax cuts.
And he also wants additional tax reductions just to encourage his ideas that now that it will encourage growth.
Yes.
You mentioned Mitt Romney, and you write that one of his advisors devised the Bush tax cuts. Safe to say he'd keep them. But what other plans does he have?
Romney is, I mean, I think it's right to think of Romney very much as the economic heir to President Bush in terms of tax policy. He would make permanent all the income tax cuts. He would also keep the estate tax abolished as President Bush favors. As you noted, one of his economic advisors is Glenn Hubbard, who's the dean of Columbia Business School, who was a quite influential advisor to President Bush during his first term, the current President Bush's first term. And so Romney is somewhat to the right on the traditional spectrum to McCain on economics, and significantly to the right of where McCain was back in 2001 or 2003.
Okay, and rounding out the Republicans is Mike Huckabee, who says, get rid of the IRS altogether.
Yeah, it's really hard to put Huckabee on the traditional spectrum. I mean, Huckabee is in favor of getting rid of the IRS, as you say, and replacing it with a national sales tax that he and its proponents call fair tax. There are really a lot of questions about a national sales tax. I think the prospect of it happening are almost nil. But the big problem from my perspective with the national sales tax is in some ways it comes to resemble a flat tax because everyone is paying roughly the same amount of tax on the items that they're buying, no matter their income. And so in order to bring in the same kind of revenue that we now have, you essentially have to raise the taxes on middle-income people and cut them significantly on upper-income people.
Okay.
And that's quite ironic because Mike Huckabee has the most populist language of any of the Republican candidates, but in some ways his tax plan is the least populist.
Hmm.
Now, people who are in favor of this tax say that in the long run the middle class comes out really well, but that's decades down the line.
Hmm. Well, let's look at the Democrats. Both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have somewhat the same thinking on the tax cut.
That's right. Very similar thinking on President Bush's tax cuts and what should happen to them.
Right.
Slightly different proposals on new tax cuts.
So on President Bush's, if I have this right from your writing, they would extend it only for families making less than $250,000?
That's right. So what they would do is, now it's important to remember, President Bush's tax cuts expire. If there are no changes to the law, they all expire in 2011. And that is because the administration and Congress basically played some games with the budget. Federal budgets are often calculated on 10-year windows. And so in order to make these tax cuts fit under the cost that they wanted to, they had them expire in the last year so that they wouldn't have the cost during that last year.
And so if we do nothing, all the tax cuts go away. The Democrats want to pass bills, new bills that would make them permanent for everyone, for all taxpayers making less than $250,000, and essentially allow the tax cuts for people making more than $250,000 to expire.
Would they actually also raise revenue, higher taxes for affluent people?
They would. Would they actually? Well, I mean, relative to what affluent people are paying now, yes, they would be higher taxes. Relevant to what the law says, what current law says affluent people will pay down the line, Obama has suggested that he would raise taxes, payroll taxes on high earners. So that would effectively be a tax increase for high earners. The key thing that Democrats want to do is, and Obama was very explicit about this when I interviewed him, he said, we have to disaggregate the way we talk about tax policy. He argued...
Disaggregate. To explain what he meant.
So he basically said for years Republicans have gotten away with this notion of, are we cutting taxes or are we raising them? And he said, I want to change the terms of this debate. I want to say that we can simultaneously raise taxes on the wealthy and cut taxes on everyone else. And the economic argument for that is, one, tax rates on high earners have fallen much more than they've fallen on middle and low earners over the last generation. And two, high earners have also done a lot better. Having nothing to do with the tax code, they've gotten much bigger raises percentage-wise and certainly dollar-wise than middle-income families have gotten. And so the argument is they've really done much, much better both for economic reasons and for tax reasons over the last generation, and we should restore that balance somewhat. And the way we restore that balance is we take away some of the tax cuts they've gotten and we essentially substitute them with new tax cuts for people in the middle of the distribution.
You know, I want to ask you right there, David, just to, in the couple minutes we have before the break, just stay with the issue of wages and income, because you wrote last November that even though the economy was in pretty good shape, the economic mood was grim, in part because of these meager pay increases, the median full-time worker making 1% less than they did in 2001 with inflation. Why is that?
Well, there are a lot of forces, and it's not just a short-term trend. It is not just about nowhere near mainly about George W. Bush. These are long-term economic trends, and the real change started sometime in the mid-1970s for a whole complex stew of reasons, including technology, which replaced a lot of the work done by blue-collar workers, to some extent globalization, although its role is often exaggerated, the decline of labor unions, the effect of decline in the minimum wage. For all sorts of reasons, pay gains for people in the middle, people, you know, making anywhere, essentially all the way down to the bottom of the income distribution, people making anywhere really below 100,000 have been really weak lately.
That's David Leonhardt, who writes about business and the economy for the New York Times and has interviewed all the presidential candidates on their stance. We spoke with him earlier today in our attempt to get back to the issues in the presidential campaign, but we are drawn back to the horse race today because midday East Coast time, breaking news, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has suspended his campaign. He will drop out of the race, effectively ceding the Republican nomination to his arch rival, John McCain. Later on Here and Now, we'll get response from a Republican strategist, but when we come back, more from David Leonhardt, back to the issues, including health care. That's in 1 minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the big political news today, as we've been reporting, is that John McCain has effectively sealed the Republican presidential nomination after his chief rival, Mitt Romney, suspended his campaign just a little while ago. We'll have more for you later in the program. But now we want to get back to the issues. Where do the candidates that are standing stand on the economy? We spoke earlier today with David Leonhardt of the New York Times before the Romney news hit and asked him to tick through the candidates for us and tell us where their economic stimulus plans are.
In some ways, their ideas for stimulating the economy, I would actually encourage people to look at them relatively briefly to get a sense for their instincts, but not to spend too much time on them. And I will tick through them. So their proposals on stimulating the economy matter, but none of them are actually going to get put into place. So John McCain argues largely for making the tax cuts permanent because he says that making the tax cuts permanent will remove uncertainty about whether people are facing a tax increase down the line and will make them more willing to invest. He also calls for some other tax ideas in there, basically to spur the economy through tax cuts. Barack Obama called for essentially speeding up his central tax plan. His central tax plan is a broad, across-the-board tax cut of about $1,000 for families in the bottom 90% or so of the income distribution, so maybe below $200,000 in the income distribution. Hillary Clinton called for a series of new spending programs. She also called for some tax cuts, but her focus was on a series of new spending programs, subsidies for home heating oil and other things. And so I think there, you mentioned targeted programs before the break, and I think there's an interesting difference between Obama and Clinton. Clinton is very much more interested in targeted programs than Obama. And the Clinton people argue that targeted programs are better because they're more cost-effective. The Obama people argue that that's unrealistic and that no matter how good targeted programs look when they're drawn up on paper, the reality of bureaucracies are that they're not as effective in real life as they are on paper. And so simple programs work better than narrowly targeted ones.
You write about the economic mood. We mentioned that maybe the economy is in some sectors going great guns, but people are depressed about it. And one other reason, the percentage of people who receive health insurance from employers has dropped. So let's just touch on health care. On the Democratic side, both Clinton and Obama have put proposals on the table. The big difference seeming to be that Clinton mandates universal care, Obama doesn't. Your colleague Paul Krugman has been arguing that Clinton, her plan works better and it will cover many more millions of uninsured Americans. But Obama, in saying he doesn't want to mandate insurance, may he have a point because here in Massachusetts, for instance, where insurance is mandated, problems are surfacing with paying for that. Your thoughts?
I don't think this difference is as big as some other people do between the two. And here's why. Hillary Clinton has not yet talked about how she would enforce her mandate. She hasn't talked about whether she would fine people. I know that you already do have small fines in Massachusetts, and they'll get bigger next year, if I'm correct. She hasn't talked about any of that. And so if you don't have fines, you're not really enforcing a mandate. And so I think the difference between the two of them is smaller than it first appears. I think Obama is underestimating the fact that even an unenforced mandate will cause some people to sign up. He sort of suggested that it won't, and I think he's wrong about that. I think Clinton is exaggerating the difference between the two. She often says, I'm for universal health care, and she's not. And her implication is that she would do much more to lower health costs than Obama would. In fact, they would essentially do the exact same thing. So for people who want to get health insurance, their proposals are essentially the same. Mm. The question is, do they mandate it? And although they are different on the mandate, because she hasn't yet talked about enforcement, they're not as different as it initially sounds.
Well, and John McCain, as he described himself to you, is a less is more guy, Teddy Roosevelt, free enterprise, capitalist, full bore, you know, with capitalism. But he also is calling, it sounds, more than his Republican counterparts for government mandates in other areas as well, against polluting facilities, for instance.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was talking to a friend of mine who is an environmentalist and who's quite liberal. This was a few weeks ago, and I was saying, you know, you really should be sending contributions to John McCain because John McCain is in the exact same place on global warming as the Democrats. He is in favor of an aggressive and, in my mind, sensible program to mandate a cap on carbon emissions and then allow for trading of these carbon permits. Once you get into the details, there actually are some significant differences, not so much between McCain and the Democrats, but among them all. But on the big picture, they're all in the same place. And so if John McCain gets the nomination, we are not going to have two candidates who disagree on the big picture question of whether we need government action to mandate climate change. By having McCain, the only Republican nominee strongly in favor of this, getting the nomination, it essentially removes that from the general election fight and means that in 2009, I think we can really be quite hopeful that we're going to have serious market-based mandates for climate change.
That's David Leonhardt. He's business and economics columnist for The New York Times. He said several months ago, it's going to be the economy. It is the economy. Thank you so much, David, for helping us take a look at the issues today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And we plan to continue doing that in the coming days, looking at the issues. Where do the candidates stand on immigration, Iraq, Homeland Security? We will do that. But if you're just joining us, we have news for you. Mitt Romney is out of the race 2 days after John McCain prevailed in most of the Super Tuesday states. He conceded today in a speech before the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington. Let's listen to a few of his remarks.
If this were only about me, I'd go on. But it's never been only about me. I entered this race because I love America. And because I love America, in this time of war, I feel I have to now stand aside for our party and for our country. You guys are great. I will continue to stand for conservative principles. I'll fight alongside you for all the things we believe in. And one of the things we believe in is that we cannot allow the next president of the United States to retreat in the face of evil extremism. It is the common task of each generation and the burden of liberty to preserve this country, expand its freedoms, and renew its spirit so that its noble past is prologued to its glorious future.
When we come back, we'll have Republican reaction to Mitt Romney dropping out of the race, ceding the Republican nomination to John McCain. That and the news still await you here and now. And then there were two. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has dropped out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination, leaving Mike Huckabee and John McCain the remaining candidates. Romney made the announcement during a speech to the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington.
This isn't an easy decision. I hate to lose. My family, my friends, you, my supporters across the country, you've given a great deal to get me where I have a shot to becoming president. If this were only about me, I'd go on. But it's never been only about me.
Joining us on the line, Todd Domke, former Republican strategist, writer for the Boston Globe, longtime observer of Mitt Romney. Todd, no real surprise, but still, your thoughts?
Well, you're right. It's not a surprise. The handwriting was on the wall after Super Tuesday. He really had no good options. He couldn't win the nomination. The delegate landslide for John McCain on Super Tuesday sealed the deal. And if he had gone on, he would have been looked upon as a sore loser and, frankly, would have had to spend a lot more of his own money just to even look viable.
And had already spent about $35 million, we think. I mean, do you have the number? We've been
$35 million is the last reported number.
Right. Well, your colleague, Dan Payne, Democratic analyst and also writer for the Boston Globe, told us earlier in the hour he felt that the problem was that Mitt Romney ran as a man that he's not, that he ran as a very right-leaning uber-conservative when 15, 20 years ago, he was for gay rights, for abortion rights. Was that part of the problem?
That was the core problem. A lot of conservatives just didn't think that he truly believed what he said, that he was pandering.
But then what happened here? Where was the disconnect? Because we know, and we've been talking in the last couple of weeks in particular about the right-wing sort of radio machinery, those conservatives, whether it was Ann Coulter or Laura Ingraham or Rush Limbaugh, local talk show hosts, they embraced him and seemed to vilify John McCain. Where was the disconnect between those uber-conservatives and the voters?
Well, a lot of conservatives enjoy listening to them for entertainment and for information, but when it comes to the judgment as to who would be the next president or who could beat the Democrats, they were thinking independently. You know, these talk show hosts do fine with ratings. It gives them a small sliver of the pie, but the voters realize that to win, you need more than 50%, and so they were not convinced that Romney was the conservative based on his past record, and they did respect and admire John McCain, not just because of his war record, but even in when he disagreed with them, because they knew he was a man of conviction.
Yeah. We have with us Fred Tice, a reporter for Here and Now and WBUR at our home station here in Boston. He's been covering the Romney campaign. Fred, you were at Romney's headquarters on Super Tuesday. He sounded very much like he was in it for the long haul.
Well, you know, he tried to make the best, put the best face on it, Robin, but it was clear that he was very disappointed when I went up to him after he made his speech and asked him how he was feeling. He was just sort of, you know, putting a smile on and saying, you know, terrific, terrific, and then just kind of walked right by me. I mean, he really didn't want to talk about what was going on that night. And I just wanted to pick up on something that Todd had just said, and then you had just said about running as the candidate that he was not. One of the interesting things that came out of the exit polling in California, in New York, and in New Jersey, the three big states, that really struck me was that Romney only won among candidates, among people that said that they thought immigration was a big issue. That was the one issue. He lost on people who thought the war was an important issue, and he even lost among people who thought that the economy was a big issue. Those people also went for John McCain.
And Todd, just to weigh in on that, because there is a feeling among Romney supporters, and they're fervent, that he would have won. He would have done better if Mike Huckabee was out of the race.
Well, yes, but it's not necessarily enough to have beaten McCain. The irony is that if he had just been the moderate Mitt Romney that got him elected governor and in his first two years as governor he was, instead of trying to reinvent himself, and especially trying to reinvent himself in every primary, he probably would be in the lead right now.
What happens now, Todd, especially since the supporters of Romney, were also bashers of John McCain, setting him up as, you know, not a conservative? Do those same, you know, people, including the talk show hosts and the analysts and the pundits, the Republican pundits, do they now have to push John McCain as a conservative? For instance, somebody, if you go to his website, you see that he's for getting rid of Roe v. Wade and appointing conservative judges.
Well, that's right. John McCain has a conservative record. I mean, I think he gets ratings like 87% or something, depending upon the conservative rating organization. But, you know, Romney has pulled the rug out from under these conservative radio talk show hosts because they also bashed Huckabee before, so they can't switch over to Huckabee. So many of them can express their disappointment, but, geez, they all of a sudden have to admit they didn't judge Mitt Romney correctly if he quits this early.
Does that change the race quite a bit on the Republican side if, in fact, they now have to push their guy as the conservative, when in fact John McCain's had so much success with independents who flocked to John McCain in part because they were told he was moderate?
That's right. This means that John McCain doesn't have to do a whole lot of reaching out to them. They're the ones who are going to have to rationalize some face-saving way to get over into his camp. Now, he is generally conservative, so it's not as if he's going to be saying anything that alienates the conservative base. But he doesn't have to worry so much about individual radio talk show hosts.
Okay. And, Fred, one last thought with you. You watched the speech today. This is, Mitt Romney has, you know, pretty much all his life been a winner. With just a few political setbacks, how did he look? And could you glean where he goes next?
Well, no, I really can't glean where he's going to go next, Robin. I mean, listening to him, I was just very struck by the emotion in his voice. I've covered him for many years, and I've never heard that kind of emotion in his voice. I did want to point something out about Super Tuesday again, and that is, while there's some places where he just lost massively. I mean, he didn't win a single county in New York, in Connecticut, or in New Jersey, three states where he could have campaigned as a moderate and done pretty well. Also in Georgia, where he did very, very well. He won the entire Atlanta metropolitan area. He carried away only three delegates. There, he seemed to have been a victim of the districting that goes on in that state because he only carried one congressional district, even though he carried the entire Atlanta metropolitan area.
That's reporter Fred Tice, who's been covering not just the Romney campaign, but the Romney career for many years now here in Boston. Fred, thanks so much for helping us out here today.
Glad to do it, Robin.
And Todd Domke, we're going to have to speak to you again, because now the whole campaign sort of rejiggers, and we'll see how it goes from here. Former Republican strategist Todd Domke, writer for the Boston Globe, I'm sure we'll be speaking again.
Good to be with you.
And again, Mitt Romney has dropped out of the campaign and effectively ceding the Republican nomination for president to John McCain. We will, of course, continue to watch this story for you. You're listening to Here and Now. At least 56 people have died as a result of the tornadoes that swept across five southern states on Tuesday. Tennessee was the hardest hit, with more than 30 people killed. President Bush will visit that state tomorrow. In the Midwest, residents of Wisconsin are digging out from 20 inches of new snow, and there are flood warnings in parts of Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, so weird weather everywhere. Ed Kieser is chief meteorologist for WILL Radio and TV in Urbana, Illinois. He's an expert in tornadoes and tornado safety. He joins us now. And Ed, here in the Northeast, where we are, we tend to think of tornadoes as a spring event. These were winter tornadoes. How common or uncommon are they?
Well, they're not as common in the middle of winter, but they do occur in the wintertime in the Gulf Coast region just about every year. The outbreak we had earlier this week was a little extreme. One thing of concern is with the 55 fatalities there so far and five fatalities in the U.S. in January, we're already at about 60, which is about average for an entire year, and we're not even into the main tornado season yet. So this is starting out as a very deadly year for tornadoes, and this could be one of the worst years in quite some time because of that. Last year, there were 81 fatalities in the U.S. during the course of the year, the entire year, from tornadoes.
We've heard from a reporter in the Tennessee area that Tornado Alley is moving. You know, that mm-hmm. it's not just that these are more extreme events, but they're coming in places that, you know, it's not like it's unheard of, but aren't as used to it. Is that true?
I don't know if I'd say Tornado Alley is moving. I will say this, even before this happened, Tennessee has been one of the states in the last 10 years or so that's had more tornado fatalities. It seems that they may be getting more tornadoes than in the past, and certainly stronger tornadoes. The main tornado alley is still Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, on over a little bit toward Illinois. The southeastern states have always had tornadoes. It just seems that maybe they're getting a few stronger ones than they used to.
And how much of that has to do with, drum roll here, global warming? You know, it's the phrase we always land on in the end of these kinds of conversations, because people are saying it's the extremes caused by global warming that are causing these severe weather systems in places where they're not expected, or at times of the year when they're not as expected.
Well, I hate to say I don't have a definitive answer on that, because the theory is that storm systems will get stronger and we would have more episodes such as this. However, we have had extremes in the past, so I don't think you can just say this is because of global warming. On the other hand, if this type of scenario becomes more common over the next 20 years, we could look back 20 years from now and say, okay, that was part of the change in climate.
Well, people right now only have to look outside their doors. You know, we feel as if in every part of the country here in New England, we might have 50 degrees one day, below zero the next. I'm reading about in Wisconsin on January 28th, they had mid-40s to zero in a couple of hours. It feels as if that's more frequent and more recent than maybe 20 years ago.
Looking back through some climate statistics, there were other periods of extreme. The 1930s, for example, there were a lot of extremes in weather. Same thing with the 1950s. In the 1950s, there were many tornado outbreaks, including some in the winter. You could go back to the 1980s and look at that as a period of rather benign weather compared to some other periods. So certainly we're having more extremes now than we had 10, 20 years ago, but it's maybe just part of a cycle as opposed to a permanent change. That's something we really just don't know at this point.
What's it like where you are today in central Illinois?
We're actually finally having a quiet day. We had a lot of rain a couple days ago. So far this month, we've had 4 inches of rain, which is double our February average. A lot of flooding in the area. To our north yesterday, the big snowstorm. Some places in northern Illinois picked up over a foot of snow. going back to Tuesday with the severe weather outbreak across Arkansas and Tennessee and Kentucky. There were some severe thunderstorms and tornadoes in southern Illinois as well. So we've had everything here recently, including the ups and downs in temperature. It's been a wild ride so far this year.
Ed Kieser, chief meteorologist for WIL Radio and TV in Urbana, Illinois. Thanks for speaking with us, Ed.
My pleasure.
Okay, we're going to take a break and come back with vintage films for kids. That's in 1 minute, here and now. President's Day is coming up. It's the start of school vacation in many parts of the country. And for those of you looking for activities for your kids, Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr has a suggestion. How about watching a movie? An old movie, maybe one in black and white. Are you saying no way? Well, so did Ty, until he showed Bringing a Baby to his little guests at his daughter's 9th birthday party. The 1938 comedy stars Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn as a zoologist and a socialite who get saddled with Baby the leopard, who loves to be sung to.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I can give, baby. Dream a while, scheme a mind.
Well, guess what? The kids loved it, and that inspired Ty to put together a collection of movies that you might want to share with your kids. His book is called The Best Old Movies for Families. We began our conversation by asking, what does he say to people who say, oh, my kids won't watch an old movie?
I would say you haven't picked the right old movie.
Yeah.
My argument is that you should start watching classic films with kids as young as possible. My daughter saw Singing in the Rain when she was 3. She didn't fully understand what was going on, but she went around singing the songs and loved it. As they get older, they just understand that classic movies are a different form of media in addition to all the other stuff that they're watching and taking in.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again.
Well, as you say, you don't have to read this book. You just use it as research when you need it. And let's briefly go through, because you have what you call a starter kit, a list of films for kids 3 to 6, then 7, 12, and 13 plus. So touch on what you think are some of the high points. I have some of the lists right here. Like, let's start with Toddler.
With any kid, if you think they're going to rebel against black and white, it's always good to find a color film. Singing in the Rain is kind of perfect.
Then The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Again, color, beautiful Technicolor, the best Robin Hood film made. Kids don't know that it was made 70 years ago.
No, it's
Errol Flynn fighting sword duels with Basil Rathbone. They almost know that sword duel from all the other films they've seen it in.
Did I upset your plans? You've come to Nottingham once too often. When this is over, my friend, there'll be no need for me to come again.
But there's no, you know, animated movies there. You really think that the little ones can do these movies?
Yeah, absolutely. You'd be surprised at how capable young children are with dealing with stories about real situations. Not necessarily grown-up situations, some grown-up situations. In my book, I have this story about watching 12 Angry Men with my daughter, who was then about 8. I'd come home from jury duty. She wanted to know what I was doing all day. I tried to explain it, and her eyes started to cross because it was pretty boring. And then literally I looked, and Turner Classics was showing 12 Angry Men in the next half hour. So we kind of cleared the decks, and we sat down and watched it, and she got it.
Remind us, 12 Angry Men.
12 Angry Men is Henry Fonda in a jury room as a juror, helping to lead the other 11 jurors to look at the case with reasonable doubt.
This kid's been kicked around all of his life. You know, born in a slum. Mother dead since he was 9. He lived for a year and a half in an orphanage when his father was serving a jail term for forgery. It's not a very happy beginning. He's a wild, angry kid. That's all he's ever been. And you know why? Because he's been hit on the head by somebody once a day, every day. He's had a pretty miserable 18 years. I just think we owe him a few words, that's all.
One of the great attractions of classic films is that they're relatively discreet. They deal with grown-up themes, but not with grown-up sex, violence, sexuality, brutality. And this is a result of the censorship code that Hollywood, worked under from the 30s through the 60s. And a lot of critics complained at the time that they sort of dumbed movies down for kids, and they had a very real point, but the irony is that they make those films wonderful for kids today.
Well, some other movies that you suggest might start great discussions about bigger moral questions are All About Eve, High Noon. I want to look at some of the other tweener films. Now, tweener, these are what, just, you know, preteens. They're not little kids, but they're not yet 13.
Right, they're from like 8 or 9 to 12 or 13.
Some like it hot for them.
Oh, absolutely. My daughters were on the floor with that and wanted to see it multiple times. Classic comic situation, guys dressed as women. And the fact that it's, you know, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. And you've also got Monroe in it, in her best film. And they know that there's something special and a little sad about her. They just pick it up.
I don't think I'm a drinker. I can stop anytime I want to, only I don't want to, especially when I'm blue.
We understand.
All the girls drink. It's just that I'm the one that gets caught. Story of my life. I always get the fuzzy end of the lollipop.
Another tweener film you recommend, The African Queen?
Mm-hmm.
They'll get that romance?
Well, they'll get that romance because it's surprising to them. I write about in the book how this is a movie about two people that most of the media kids see generally marginalizes, the slobby janitor and the prissy librarian.
Humphrey Bogart.
Humphrey Bogart and Kate Hepburn. And it puts them in a boat together. And they start out as cartoons, and they get humanized. They fall in love with each other over the course of the movie. And for kids, they go from being cartoons to real people.
Well, miss?
Yes, Mr. Walnut.
How'd you like it?
Like it?
White water, rapid.
I never dreamed.
I don't blame you for being scared, miss, not one little bit. Ain't no person in their right mind ain't scared of white water.
I never dreamed that any mere physical experience could be so stimulating.
Teenagers. Psycho.
Here's my feeling on putting Psycho in there. I figure by the time modern American kids are 13 or 14 or 15, they're already seeing The Messengers. They're already seeing The Hitcher. Why not show them horror movie 1.0, the beginning modern horror movie?
Rebel Without a Cause you include as well, and for nothing else they could have a crush on Sal Mineo. I mean, why that film?
Or Natalie Wood, or James Dean.
It's so many to choose from.
Because to me it's as timeless as Catcher in the Rye is in literature. If you are an adolescent and you feel like the world is going on, or, you know, around you, not with you, and you feel out of sync, this is a movie that still speaks to you.
You're tearing me apart!
What?
You say one thing, he says another, and everybody changes back again!
That's a fine way to behave.
Well, you know who he takes after.
By the way, you know, another thing is, do you recommend people watch these with their kids?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you don't want to put on Psycho and walk out of the room.
Yeah.
The nice thing about watching a classic film is that you can watch together.
But I wonder, too, were there films that you tested on your kids that they said they didn't like?
Oh, absolutely. Gone with the Wind did not play to my daughters. All they could see was these African-American characters that were being silly. They kept asking about Butterfly McQueen. Why is she so silly? And I had to answer, well, that's how Hollywood movies treated black characters back then.
Right. Well, maybe for nothing else, that was a good lesson.
It was an eye-opener, and we had a really good discussion about it. Every movie is a different experience with your kids, but every old movie is a chance to discuss something about the culture in which they live, history, past, in a way that isn't forced, in a way that just comes up. When you watch Casablanca, you have to sort of sketch out some of the basics of World War II, whether you like it or not. And once they get that under their belt, they're often running into the film, but they also come out with a little understanding of the world and the past.
As time goes by.
Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, his book is The Best Old Movies for Families, A Guide to Watching Together. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
No matter what the future brings, as time goes by.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Hearts full of passion, jealousy, and hate. Woman need man, and man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still a same old story. A fight for love and glory. A case of do or die. The world.